a religious test for holding a public office. And so we'll let the critics roll off our back, but this criticism of Christian education in America should stop.
A passenger who jumped from the 11th floor balcony of a ship ended up being kicked off the cruise line forever. Royal Caribbean Cruise Line says Nick Native of Vancouver, Washington, is no longer welcome on any of their cruises. He tells ABC's Good Morning America the reason he jumped.
I just thought it'd be cool to just jump off the ship. All my friends cheered me on, and it just happened so quick. And, you know, the next minute I was jumping off the ship.
Native's buddies who egged him on were also banned for life from any Royal Caribbean cruises as well. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com. And I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutterton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon, the 18th of January, and for those of you who have a holiday on Monday from work, maybe rather snowed in, but let's take a look at the weather. I'm Pat Smits, and right now I am your weather person. So right now it has been overcast, not sunny day. There is a slight chance of snow in the forecast after 2 p.m. So far, I have not seen anything around Hunterdon County. But then the chance of precipitation, today, there really is just a partly cloudy tonight. It's tomorrow that there's a slight chance of snow, and then a 90% chance of snow. But it's not going to be a big accumulation, probably less than an inch. Into Saturday night, however, there is a chance, more than a chance, there's a prediction of 100% heavy snow and then a wintry mix. And that's what we have to be careful about, because before midnight, it's supposed to snow and then sleet between midnight and about 1 a.m. and then turn to rain. So this could be, not only could the snow be heavy at times, but depending on the temperature, and it is supposed to get a low of about 30 degrees, if, in fact, it's sleet and then rain and still stays cold, you have to look out, really look out, and carefully look out for black ice. Into Sunday, there is, again, starts out with a wintry mix or snow or rain, depending where you are, in the morning, and then as probably freezing rain in this area, and then freezing rain mixed with sleet, then snow, freezing rain, sleet for the rest of the morning after 10 a.m., and about in the afternoon, probably snow, high near 31 degrees, and so that's what's going to make the difference. Could be gusts winds high of about 29%. So the precipitation, according to the prediction, is that it's 100% on Sunday, and then there could be a new ice accumulation or possibly an inch of snow, depending on where we are, what we get, but not supposed to be significant amounts, just that it's going to be treacherous. So again, Sunday night, there's about a 30% chance of snow. Then it should be partly cloudy. And Martin Luther King Day Monday, we're expecting sunny, high of only about 15 degrees. So you'll have to still be careful depending on whether or not there is rain at some point, rain, because it'll be certainly icy. By Monday night, it's supposed to be clear. So in any event, this is a weekend to figure out what you want to do inside, bundle up. Of course, we have football, And but this is the time to be, you know, somewhat careful when you're going outside. Be careful of walking. Be careful of the ice. The black ice is really treacherous. You cannot drive on black ice with any kind of insurance. I don't care what kind of a car you have. I'm sure that they'll be out sanding and spraying the roads and doing whatever is possible. But if you live on one of the back roads, especially, be very careful. So we'll be back just after commercial, and hopefully this is not a commercial for the expo. My sense is that it still is, unless they change the commercial. So I'll stop it immediately. If you're still listening to the expo.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio.
I guess I was right. This spot is still on, and it is, of course, about the expo. So let's try another one.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Hey, that was my mistake. They actually changed that ad. We're now talking about supporting us, supporting the radio, and that would be a good thing. So, what's happening? The program, of course, it's the law. I'm Pat Smith, an attorney here in Hunterdon County. My practice is devoted to family law matters. Was in court yesterday on a guardianship matter, so that's a little different than most of what I do, but it can be just as difficult. So what's happening in the law? I think there was a case this year that was, in fact, very important, and it's important for everyone, important for anyone who has to sign an agreement. And this is a case where it came before the Supreme Court of New Jersey. Actually, the decision in this case, and the reason it's still important, is things are coming up that it's still not only relevant but important. And it was a decision that ruled that disclaimers in agreement, an agreement that employers require workers to sign as a condition of employment, violate public policy if the disclaimers force employees to waive their right to sue for third-party claims if they are injured on a third-party job site. So in other words, the situation is an employer who signs on employees, or an employee who signs on with an employer, there can't be a complete waiver to waive the employee's right to sue a third party if they are injured on a third-party job site. So this is very different than an agreement with respect to the employee's own employer. So that this was a unanimous opinion, and that the disclaimer, at least in this one, contravenes public policy, and by virtue of its waiver of any third-party action, the disclaimer would alter the balancing of interest of the employer, the employee, and a potentially liable party that the legislature envisioned when it enacted the New Jersey Workman's Comp Act. That's Workers' Compensation Act. And, of course, the Workers' Compensation Act does cover employees injured on their employer's property. What else? There was in a case, again, 2018, and this was the court where Haynes versus Turnerville Chrysler Jeep, and in this case, a decision denying a motion to enforce an arbitration agreement. Now, that is a final order subject to a 20-day limitation for filing a motion for reconsideration. But this case really shows how important it is to follow the rules with respect to deadlines. And in this case, the appellate division relied upon the explicit language of a rule which provides that appeals may be taken to the appellate division as a right from final judgments of the superior court divisions. And the rule further provides that any order either compelling arbitration, whether the action is dismissed or stayed, or denying arbitration, shall also be deemed a final judgment of the court for appeal processes. So that the question in this case, the motion had defendant had waited for 101 days and then moved for reconsideration under a rule, we call it Rule 4:49, and the reconsideration was denied. And so that, you know, the only recourse of the defendant was to file a timely direct appeal to the appellate division. But again, he could not wait 101 days to do that. There was a another case that is some, everybody should know what this means. In other words, when there is an offer of judgment, and very often what happens is there will be, prior to trial, in this case, the plaintiff served the defendant with an offer of judgment for $750,000, inclusive of costs and prejudgment interest, and warning the plaintiff in that case would seek all reasonable litigation expenses. And what happened is the defendant rejected the offer, and then the parties entered into what we call a high-low agreement. And what that means is they're, both sides are wanting to limit their exposure. So in this case, there was an offer of judgment of $750,000 that was rejected. And then the parties entered into what we call a high-low agreement of $300,000 to $1 million. Now, that meant that if the jury came in with $200,000, the plaintiff still received $300,000. However, if the jury came in with $5 million, the plaintiff was limited to $1 million. So that's what a high-low is. And people ask that all the time. Why would you do it? Well, it's helping to avoid the risk of, you know, getting much less, or for the insurance company having to pay much more. So the question, however, in this case is that neither party explicitly waived or preserved their rights to seek litigation expenses once they did the high-low. And you must specify if litigation costs and interest and experts' fees, for example, are included or not when you're dealing with this high-low, because otherwise someone could actually owe more money because of the cost of the litigation and the expert fees. So, and by the way, in that case, there was a $6 million verdict, and that was from the trial court. However, the judge did mold the verdict to conform to the high-low agreement, so that in the case, the plaintiff was only awarded $1 million, but then, as I said, the question was, the plaintiff then moved for litigation expenses. The trial court denied that after applying a custom and usage analysis. And so what happened when it went up to appeal, the appellate division held the plaintiff could not seek more than the high limit unless she explicitly preserved her rights to seek litigation costs in addition to the high-low award. So if someone, for example, is in a case that there are very expensive experts costs and they want to enter into a high-low agreement, they have to either specifically, save the experts' fees. For example, they have to say that if they get the high, or if the low, that they're entitled to file for expert fees, or that expert fees would be on top of this. So very, very important. Obviously, the lawyers handling this was not thinking about it, so you can imagine how unhappy the plaintiff was. Not only instead of a $6 million verdict did she get a $1 million verdict, but she also had to pay all the litigation costs. There are some cases where we're talking about fee shifting, and there was a case where it was a product liability case, again in 2018, and the plaintiff was injured while climbing a rock wall, and so prior to trial, the plaintiff filed an offer of judgment against all defendants for $125,000. The jury in the case returned a verdict of $358,000 against two defendants, one of whom was found 70% responsible and the other 30%. So the question was, it was a blanket offer of judgment, and what should have happened is there should have, since there were three defendants, should have figured out and probably done it separately. I do not handle civil cases, but certainly that was a mistake because that didn't end all the litigation. There was a, that was 2017. Statute of limitations, very important, Baez versus Paulo, P-A-U-L-O, 2018 case, and that was medical malpractice death case. And approximately a year of discovery, three defendant doctors moved for summary judgment based on a statute of limitations. What happened is the appellate division overturned the equitable estoppel ruling because they said in the absence of a court rule or case management order prescribing an earlier filing deadline, the defendants did not forfeit their right to file limitations-based motions near the end of the discovery period. So what this means out there, if you're someone who's involved in litigation, you need to make sure that your attorney is making sure to deal with all the deadlines. And what you have to do is you have to cooperate as a litigant with the attorney and make sure that deadlines are not missed. But this also means that it's unfair to the attorney if you don't cooperate and try to do everything at the last minute, because that's one of the reasons that things are missed and timely, not filed on a timely basis. So it's very important. You don't have to bug the attorney every day, but you have to be ready to produce what you need to produce. You need to do what you need to do, and give the attorney time to do what he or she needs to do. There's a case, Jacobs versus Jersey Central Power and Light Company. This was from 2017, but again, I'm not a fan of Jersey Central Power and Light. I find that they were, they're not exactly as helpful as I found JCP&L in the past. But there were guidelines, and This was an excellent judge, Judge Sabatino. He said that the expert witness rule 702, which is a rule of court, is permissive. And the rule provides, however, that if scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge will assist the trier of fact, meaning the judge, or the jury, if it's a jury trial, to understand the evidence or to determine a fact and issue, then an expert witness may testify thereto in the form of an opinion or otherwise. However, this does not mean whether or not an expert is needed, because that's always discretionary. Indeed, an expert's testimony is necessary where the subject matter of the intended testimony is beyond the what they call the ken of the average juror. In other words, if something, basically, if a jury can understand, then you don't need an expert. So if it's something in common knowledge. So in this particular case, the trial court applied the guidelines that the court has to file. I'm sorry, the court has to follow. And because it, you know, there was an interpretation of the rules, because there were three questions that the judge had to decide. First of all, who decides whether an expert is needed? And second, when is a subject matter, quote, beyond the ken, end quote, of a jury? And three, who has the burden of establishing the need for an expert? So the judge answered those questions in connection with that case and then applied the guidelines. And the court, whether JCP&L acted reasonably with respect to the condition defendant left on plaintiff's property after removing the light pole. Second, whether waiting approximately 2 months to return to the site to make the necessary repair was unreasonable. And what happened is the appellate division said that Judge Sabatino properly held that these issues were subject within the common knowledge of laymen and capable of being decided by the jury without expert opinion. And I think we would all agree with that. In other words, did JCP&L act reasonably to whatever condition the property was left in? And I think most people could make a decision on looking at the property, what was the condition, and was that reasonable? And secondly, whether or not a two-month delay in making the repairs was reasonable. And the average jury, of course, would look at that and, depending on what was needed, determine whether or not it was reasonable. For example, I can assume that if something happened in the middle of the winter and the ground was frozen and for some reason, in order to make the appropriate repair, there had to be something dug up and, you know, then it might be reasonable to wait 2 months. Other time of the year, might not be reasonable, especially where the damage was. You know, if the people could not get in their front door, and I'm not saying that that's the case, but for example, I think we'd all think of a situation where, depending on the circumstances, specific circumstances, it would be reasonable or not reasonable. So, talking about reasonable, I think it's time to tell you who's sponsoring the program today, and I'll do that and be back shortly.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Retail personnel is your staffing solution. located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
This is Tony Clark, para-planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Well, we're back. Program It's the Law. I'm Pat Smits, and just wanted to let you know about something that's happening in the community tomorrow night, and this is at Zoop at the Shops at Flemington. There's going to be an open mic, meaning that there will be musicians and believe comedians, and this is tomorrow night, Saturday the 19th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. And that's at Zoop. No reservations are needed, and there is no cost. And Zoop is at the Shops at Flemington. Their address is, I believe it's 100 Rayville Avenue in Flemington. And feel free to, join the, I think this is the first open mic that they're having, and they do have people lined up. So it might be a fun night. I know you have to be at least 16 years old, although there's no liquor, so that's not the reason. I'm sure the reason is, some comedians, they do their own act. What can I say? So we're back, and again, we're talking about some of the decisions now, the recent decisions for publication. There was an approved publication. In fact, it was approved just yesterday. And that was the plaintiffs in that case appealed from the appellate division's ruling affirming the attorney general's decision to deny them a defense and immunity. So obviously save the taxpayers some money. So what happened is, in this case, the plaintiffs administered a polygraph test to a suspect charged with robbery and aggravated assault, and did this after the suspect asserted his innocence and stipulated to the admissions of the polygraph. So that unless a defendant voluntarily agrees to take a polygraph, and voluntarily agrees and stipulates that the results of the polygraph can be admitted in evidence in court, a polygraph cannot be admitted. So in this situation, the plaintiff who administered the test, testified at the suspect's trial as the state's polygraph expert. And he testified that the polygraphs, and this is a quote, weren't just a lie detector. And then, not quote, but go on to say, but also a truth indicator. And this is what makes this so important, because he said that the polygraph is a truth indicator, and that it was his opinion that the suspect, quote, wasn't telling the truth. And as a, we don't know if it was as a result, but in fact the suspect was convicted, and then the conviction was reversed after the polygrapher, no, I guess he wouldn't be a polygrapher, but anyway, after the person who administered the polygraph, after his testimony was found improper, because it could have led the jury to believe that polygraphs are infallible, and also to give the polygraph results disproportionate weight. And on retrial, the suspect was acquitted on retrial and filed suit against the plaintiffs for wrongful prosecution and conviction, because the polygraph and testimony were contributing causes to his prosecution and conviction. So then the plaintiffs and the prosecutors requested the Attorney General to defend and indemnify them. And the Attorney General agreed to indemnify the prosecutors, but not the plaintiffs who had administered the polygraph. And the Attorney General concluded that the law did not require indemnity of county police officers, who were instead required to be indemnified by their respective counties. So the plaintiffs appealed, and the appellate division agreed with the Attorney General. So on appeal to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court affirmed, concurring with the Attorney General's conclusion that statutory law required each county, not the Attorney General, to defend and indemnify the police officers. And then the Supreme Court declined to extend the case law that granted state indemnity, indemnity to county prosecutors based on their, what they called their hybrid status. And because the prosecutors, as county employees, also enforce the state's laws and perform functions for which the Attorney General was ultimately answerable. So there was a difference here as to what they, who they would actually agree to, you know, defend, basically defend. There is another case which I found interesting. Hope you do. The Plaintiff Surgery Center versus Maloff Chevrolet Cadillac. This is a appellate division case. And the plaintiffs in that case were various medical providers, and they appealed the denial of their petitions for payment of services rendered to employees pursuant to their workers' compensation benefits. So in this case, each plaintiff filed their claim more than 2 years from the date of their patient's accident, but less than 6 years from the claim's accrual. Now, this means what statute of limitations will be applied. So the trial court dismissed each petition, and the trial court applied the 2-year statute of limitations that is found in the Workers' Compensation Act. Okay. Rather than the 6-year statute of limitation period in contested actions. So that's the issue. Was it a 2-year statute of limitations or a 6-year limitation? So the legislature had previously amended the act to exclusive jurisdiction over disputed medical charges, meaning the Workers' Compensation Act. And so they amended it to grant exclusive jurisdiction over disputed medical charges arising from compensation for work-related injuries or illnesses to the Division of Workers' Compensation. However, the legislature's amendment was silent as to whether it also intended to alternate the limitation period for which a medical provider's claim must be commenced. So that was the question. So the arguments were back and forth. The court in this case rejected the defendant's arguments and reversed the denial of plaintiff's petitions. The court rejected defendant's arguments held that the legislature's silence, I guess I should say, was indicative of their intent to leave everything with a 6-year limitation period intact. So the fact that they didn't change it, the court felt that that was, they didn't change it because their intention was to leave it the 6-year statute of limitation. The court also agreed with plaintiffs that the term claimant has always been understood to mean employees. There was probably some issue about that. Finally, the court noted that shortening the limitations period for medical claimants would mean many of their claims would naturally expire before they could accrue, since the employees might continue to seek treatment more than 2 years after their accidents. So, I mean, a 2-year statute of limitations really doesn't make any sense when you think about it, since so many injuries, you know, are persistent and longer term. So the court rejected defendants' invitation to measure the 2-year limitations period from the accrual of the claim, noting that the Act expressly measured the 2-year period from the date of an employee's accident. So that was the 2-year statute of limitations or 6-year statute of limitations. The point of this is that it's extremely important to know what the statute of limitations is, number one, and number two, when the time starts to run. Okay? For example, in matrimonial cases, there are different tracks for discovery. So one of the tracks is a standard track where the litigants only have 120 days to do discovery. Well, what happens in a case if the defendant isn't served until 119 days before the end of that? When does it start? In other words, does it start the day the complaint was filed? Does it start the day the complaint was received? Does it start the date that the defendant filed a counterclaim or an answer? You know, all of these are, you know, issues that attorneys need to know or find out, and then sometimes there's a real gray area. So that's a real problem, because a lot of these things you would expect we would know, but frankly, it's sometimes what we say depends on the judge. There was a civil rights criminal law case that was approved for publication, and that was State versus Santa Maria. And this appellate division, the state and defendant cross-appealed from a decision of the appellate division, which reversed defendants' convictions and remanded for a new trial. A defendant, who was a middle school teacher, was tried and convicted for aggravated sexual assault and official misconduct for his sexual relationship with a student. Defendant and the student's relationship began after the student's 14th birthday, and continued after the student entered college. Student ultimately contacted the police and agreed to wear a wire during a conversation with the defendant. Now, during that conversation, the defendant made no admissions or denials. Instead, you know, talking about fun and games, instead, in this case, the defendant's ex-wife turned over a CD containing suggestive and explicit photos of the defendant and his former student. At trial, although the parties agreed that the photos were consensually taken after the student turned 18, the state argued that she would not have taken such photos in a new relationship and suggested that the photos indicated that she had a long relationship with the defendant. So, in this case, during the closing arguments, the prosecutor highlighted the student's accusation on the wire recording that the defendant raped her when she was 14. Now, they used this, although the defendant did not respond to the accusation when his former student made it. Defendant was convicted, but the appellate division reversed the ruling, ruling that the trial court should have excluded the photos as cumulative and unduly prejudicial. That's very important, that evidence, even though it shows something, if it's unduly prejudicial, it can be excluded. Now, I don't see judges doing that when they're the trier of fact, meaning when there's not a jury. But cumulative means that you don't need it, or I guess I should say it means that you don't pile it on. Okay? You don't, if you have, you know, three pieces of evidence that support something, strongly support something, you don't need 4, 5, 6, or 10. That can be cumulative. So now, as I said, the appellate court further concurred that the defendant, that the state improperly commented on defendant's silence on the wire recording. In other words, they obviously must have said something like, see, he would have said something, he would have defended himself, because he didn't say anything, that means he's guilty. So then on appeal to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court reversed the appellate court's decision, ruling that it was not plain error to admit the photographs or permit the state to comment on the defendant's silence. The Supreme Court ruled that the photographs were properly used to demonstrate that the defendant and his former student's consensual relationship began before she turned 18. The Supreme Court further ruled that pre-arrest silence without the threat of arrest or government compulsion, if used to impeach the defendant's credibility, it did not infringe on the privilege against self-incrimination. So, you know, lots of stuff in that case. So let me do what I need to do. I'll bring you a few more commercials, and then we'll be back to finish the program.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, I'm back. Pat Smits, It's the Law. I thought I'd talk about another case, although it was not published. Shows to me, there are some cases that never end, and this seemed to be one of them. In this case, it was in the matter of the estate of Catherine Parker Blair. And the petitioner was Lori Ann Parker, and she appealed for the third time in a case involving the estate of her sister. On the first appeal, the court affirmed the trial court's grant of summary judgment to the estate. On Parker's second appeal, the court found her substantive claims were meritless. So this, you know, that was the second appeal. And then the Supreme Court, after that second appeal, denied certification, meaning that unless one of the judges in the appellate division dissents, you have a right to appeal. There's certain constitutional issues that there is a right to appeal to the Supreme Court, but in most cases, the Supreme Court decides which cases they're going to hear, so that there is a petition for certification, and then, as I said, the chance of success that even getting the Supreme Court to hear it, pretty minimal actually. But in this case, after the Supreme Court denied certification or denied what we call denied cert, Parker filed the motion that is now under review in this case, and she labeled it a request to reopen. And so what happened, and that was back with the trial court denied the motion, and then 2 days before her death, the decedent executed a new will, which they did not name Parker, which she did not name Parker as a beneficiary. So the will was probated, and subsequently Parker filed a complaint that sought to have the executor show cause why the probate of the new will should not have been vacated. In the alternative, Parker sought a declaration that, among other things, the probated will was the product of undue influence and the decedent lacked testamentary capacity to execute the will, and that it therefore should have been set aside. So after much litigation, Parker eventually appealed various trial court orders and argued that the trial court erred in dismissing Parker's motion to reopen and then in denying it. So the court addressed the motion as a motion for reconsideration and found that Parker's arguments lacked sufficient merit to warrant discussion in a written opinion. So this was, as I said, this was an appellate division, overly litigated case. Not published, but it would be of interest or should be of interest to someone who, you know, wants to keep going irrespective of what's happened before. Well, you know, there was a case addressing an issue that's unresolved by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, and that a federal judge has ruled that a transportation company can be held liable for failing to stop an employee from being repeatedly harassed by a non-employee. Very interesting. So the decision was that the company should have done whatever was necessary to prevent, maybe not whatever was necessary, but they should have done something to protect their employee from harassment by someone who was not a member, not an employee. So that is pretty significant, actually, because the company has to be aware, in this case it was harassment by someone not employed by the employer. So there's, you know, Ukrainian man, you know, some of this stuff, sometimes if you put it up in big, bold letters, it would actually look like yellow journalism, I guess they used to call it. So that other cases, and there are some interesting ones, but a lot of them are not for publication, meaning, as I said before, you can't use it for precedent. So many attorneys don't even want to read those because, you know, I frankly think a lot of the unpublished cases make a lot of sense to read because a lot of times there's some very good information that, although you can't use the case for precedent, you can certainly use the case, because of the issue, if that issue comes up again, and you can't use the case, but you can use whatever the, you know, however the judge ruled, you can make your argument based on that. Okay. So, now, in another case, one of the problems, of course, is there is always request for identification of witnesses, and there was a case decided this week that an appellate court affirmed a trial court's decision barring a physician's testimony on behalf of the injured at his trial. And the insured had not identified the physician as a possible witness, and then notwithstanding the fact that the physician previously conducted an independent medical examination of the insured on behalf of her insurer. So that, a proof for publication, a case where the plaintiff was a what happened is the New Jersey State Parole Board decided, and ordered the plaintiff to undergo psychological evaluation for violation of certain conditions of parole supervision. And he was had parole supervision for life and mandatory parole supervision. So, of course, you know, when someone is released from prison on parole, that is, there are conditions. And in this case, that was one of the conditions. And, you know, you can almost be sure that most of these cases will have some sexual implications. And in this case, the plaintiff, Mr. Norman, had pled guilty to aggravated sexual assault and was sentenced to 7 years incarceration at the prison for sexual offenders. And parole suspension for life, that's what he was convicted for. And parole suspension for life following the custodial portion of his sentence. So basically he was sentenced for life, part of it to be spent in prison at Avenel. I believe that's ADTC is the old, what we called Avenel. And then part of it sentenced there, and then the rest of it paroled for life. So the plaintiff was discharged from Avenel following completion of his sentence and was paroled for 5 years pursuant to the mandatory parole supervision, also beginning his parole supervision for life. So he later was arrested for violating parole by failing to inform his parole officer that he had been terminated from employment. And remember, when you're on parole, it can be very, very strict. And so that was the parole board revoked his mandatory supervision and ordered him to undergo a psychological evaluation, and on and on and on. Well, at this point, it's time to end the show. So in this case, and it's Norman versus New Jersey State Parole Board, the court ruled that the court in this case reversed in part and affirmed in part. The court ruled that psychological evaluation could only be a condition for parole for inmates serving their sentence pursuant to a different statute than the statute under which the plaintiff was serving his sentence of parole. So the court noted that plaintiff had already completed his custodial sentence and therefore was no longer subject to provisions of the Sex Offender Act. The court held that parole was not a continuation of his sentence. However, the court affirmed the appellant's or the plaintiff's custodial sentence for the purpose of violating his parole and finding that the board had imposed special conditions. So this is, again, not that clear-cut, but let's just play, end the show, play the news, give you some weather, and be back with the sports guys. And if anyone has any questions or wants anything discussed on this program, you can certainly call me. My name is Pat Smits. Number is 908-236-7530. I cannot answer questions about specific cases, but I'm certainly, if you have any suggestions about people you would like me to interview on the program, I am certainly more than happy to try to reach out to those people as long as the topic is law-related. Anyway, back after the news.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders is shooting down an unsourced BuzzFeed story that says President Trump counseled former lawyer Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about a Moscow Trump Tower project.
That one statement, those two words, sum it up better than anything anybody else can say, and that it's categorically false.
as the partial government shutdown continues. No real end in sight, as lawmakers are not meeting today and no votes are scheduled either in the House and Senate. Republican Senator John Kennedy tells Fox News the president, he's willing to negotiate.
He's willing to negotiate. Mm-hmm. Some of my colleagues in Congress are running around. I don't mean any disrespect. I'm glad they're talking, but some of them are running around like sprayed roaches, coming up with deals to bring to him, none of which include a border wall.
This is USA Radio News.
The backyard's looking great, Rob.
Thanks, man. I was planning on adding a deck, too. Know any good contractors?
Why don't you just ask HomeAdvisor?
Home what?
HomeAdvisor.com. You just tell them about your project, and they match you with local pros that can do the job.
Nice. Now, how much does it cost?
Oh, HomeAdvisor's totally free to use. Plus, you can read customer reviews, check pricing, and book appointments for free.
What's the website again?
HomeAdvisor.com. Or just download the free HomeAdvisor app. HomeAdvisor.